Rebecca turns her face, but not her eyes, toward him. "I used to talk," she says. "Now I don't talk anymore." Beto sits up and brushes the salt and the sunflower seed dust from his fingertips. "Fair enough," he says. 2 hours later, they slow, but do not stop, as they pass through the small town of Benjamin Hill. And Luca feels encouraged by the fact that, after the tangle of tracks recedes back to a single line, they've emerged on the easternmost route, which continues due north toward Nogales. Santa Ana, Los Janos, Bambuto. Check, check, check. By early afternoon, Luca spots an airplane low in the sky. It becomes larger and flies lower until it seems like it will collide with their train. They all duck, pinning themselves flat to the top of the train as they pass the runway of Nogales International Airport. Chapter 26. Nogales makes them feel almost as if they've arrived in the United States already. The train slows way down and chugs right through the middle of the city. The streets are wider than Luca has seen elsewhere. The cars are bigger. There's a giant Coca-Cola can perched atop a building and countless radio towers stretching up into the sky. And then, they all see it at the same time. A huge green highway sign with white writing and an arrow. There are only 3 letters on the sign. USA. Soledad begins to cry. She doesn't even try to keep from crying. She lets the tears stream down and the snot fill her nose and overflow. And this she wipes with the back of her wrist. But Rebecca puts an arm around her, which makes Soledad cry even harder.
"We made it," she whispers to her little sister.
Beto stands up on top of the train, an action that makes Lydia feel almost instantly hysterical, and says without deliberate cruelty, "Not yet. You didn't." Luca pinches him on the back of the leg. "Oh," Beto says. "I mean, you will. You will. You're going to make it."
"You have no idea how far we've come," Soledad says. "Even just to see it."
The train is slowing, and there's the lurching they've all become accustomed to, so that Beto has to stagger a bit, 1 or 2 steps forward, 1/2 step back, and then Lydia can't take it any longer, and she yells at him,
"For God's sake, would you sit down before you get yourself killed? You're not made of rubber."
And she feels self-conscious about the unintentional sharpness of her outburst. But Beto sits down without argument and grins at her. She clutches at her chest.
"Thank you," she says.
They wait until the train stops before they all climb down to the pavement. There's no station here, but it's stopped for a red signal, and they're close enough to the border that they won't have to walk for miles, and yet far enough to avoid a run-in with La Migra. As soon as she sets foot on the asphalt, Lydia feels a tremor of excitement travel through her whole body. She feels the exhaustion of this journey drop away from her shoulders, all the trauma and grief and guilt and horror submerge beneath a skin of new possibility. She turns back to the ladder and lifts Luca down by the armpits.
"Mommy, stop! I can do it," he says.
And Lydia realizes that the presence of Beto has returned yet another of her son's temporarily suspended features. Parental embarrassment. She's happy to see it.
"Sorry," she says. "You guys hungry?" Beto asks.
"I'm starving. I'm going to go find some lonche. You wanna come?"
"Lonche?"
Luca asks. "Almuerzo," Mommy translates. "Lunch."
"Yeah, I want some lonche," Luca says.
"I could go for some lonche," Soledad agrees.
Lydia thinks about the cash they have left, just over $100. They need to eat, but that money won't last. Beto sees her hesitation.
"I'm buying," he says.
They walk north along the main avenue, and when Beto spots a birrieria, they stop and order 5 portions of the spicy stew. When he opens his pocket wide enough to take some money out, Lydia sees the big wad of cash he has in there, and all at once, her fear returns. They'd been foolish to trust this kid so easily, regardless of the hole in his shoe, regardless of the empty inhaler. No 10-year-old should be walking around with that kind of money in Nogales. There's only one source of potential income for a kid like this, Lydia knows. She stiffens, but the vendor is passing her a styrofoam bowl with fragrant steam curling up the handle of the spoon. She can't help but fall onto it with vigor. The last time they ate well was in Culiacán. Her suspicions can wait until after lonche.
Ay, Dios mío, thank you,
Soledad says with her mouth full of food. Beto nods. Let's go see it. I want to go see it, Soledad says. Then just look, Beto says, gesturing with his spoon. Soledad follows the direction of the spoon, and she sees, not half a block from where they're standing, with their toes pointing north, flapping against the stark sunshine, the red and white stripes, the blue starfield of the American flag.
It's right there, she says, forgetting her food for a moment. That's not it, is it?
That's it, Beto nods, shoveling in a mouthful.
But it looks so...
Soledad doesn't know how to finish the sentence. This street dead ends in a fishbowl of concrete, a line of shops to the right, some formidable, blockish government buildings to the left, and a wall directly in front, which is topped with a second wall, which is topped with a third wall, which is topped with razor wire and mounted cameras. It's behind this wall, stretching high up into the sky, that the American flag moves stiffly in the mild wind. Only a few feet away from it, on this side of the fence, a Mexican flag also flies. See? Beto says, pointing to the Mexican flag. This is the whole problem, right?
Look at that American flag over there. You see it? All bright and shiny. It looks brand new. And then look at ours. It's all busted up and raggedy. The red doesn't even look red anymore. It's pink.
Luca and the sisters walk toward the Mexican flag and then past it. They approach the wall at a section of open screen where they can see through to the other side. Lydia hangs back with Beto, who's seen it all before. It's good to have a minute alone with him anyway. She wants to interrogate him about the money.
It's like we don't have any pride, like we don't even care, Beto is saying. I mean, why does their flag have to be so much higher? How hard would it be to get a taller flagpole?
Lydia looks up and sees that he's right. The Mexican flag here does look tattered and sunbleached, and the red, white, and blue one appears pristine behind it, like it was replaced just this morning.
I don't know, she says. Imagine replacing that flag every week, how expensive that would be. What's the point?
Beto tosses his spoon into a planter and tips the styrofoam into his mouth. He slurps it.
Seems like a lot of jingoism, if you ask me, Lydia says. A lot of what?
Wasted money.
I guess, Beto shrugs. I mean, those estadounidenses are obsessed with their flag.
He tosses the remainder of the stew into his mouth and then pitches the styrofoam into the planter after the spoon.
Can I ask you something? Lydia asks. Speaking of money?
Sure. But the mention of money makes him shift his weight. She clears her throat. I couldn't help but notice you're carrying quite a lot of it there.
Beto slings his hand instinctively into his pocket.
Lydia keeps one eye on Luca and the sisters while she bends to retrieve Beto's discarded spoon and bowl. She sets her own bowl of half-eaten stew on the edge of the planter and takes Beto's garbage to a nearby trash can. When she returns, he's seated on the edge of the planter beside her birria. She lifts it and sits beside him, taking another bite.
It's my money, he says. I didn't steal it.
No, Lydia says, I'm not accusing you.
I didn't do anything bad for it either.
Lydia continues to eat. It's none of my business, I know, she says between bites. But of course it makes me curious. Sometimes money is cause for concern, especially here. Especially when it's a young person who has a lot of money without having a job or a rich family.
Beto stares at a wad of gum beside his feet.
I could have a rich uncle.
Lydia frowns.
Listen, you seem like a nice kid, but we've had enough trouble already, she says. We really can't afford any more.
Beto sits up out of his slouch and answers defensively.
I got it by selling some stuff.
Lydia sets her spoon into her empty styrofoam bowl and waits a beat to see if he'll continue. When he doesn't, she prompts him.
What kind of stuff?
Beto leans down to rest his elbows on his knees, which isn't easy for him since his feet don't quite reach the ground.
I found a gun, he says,
and then he looks at her to gauge her response before continuing. She doesn't seem alarmed, so he goes on.
And I found some drugs.
She nods, okay.
And I didn't even really sell the stuff. I just returned it to the guy in El Dompe who I knew it probably belonged to.
So the money was more like a reward?
Yeah, I guess. He asked me if I wanted to work for him, and I said what I really wanted was to get out of El Dompe and go north. So he gave me the money.
But that much? Beto shrugs.
I think he felt bad for me because of Ignacio and stuff. Everybody in El Dompe was always feeling bad for me after that, and after my mommy disappeared.
Lydia bites her lip.
He didn't even count it. He just went to his lockbox and grabbed me a fat stack of cash. Told me to go to Nogales if I really wanted to cross.
He didn't even count it.
Nah.
Lydia doesn't think he'd bother lying. He seems completely guileless, and he doesn't owe her an explanation anyway. But it's so far-fetched. Why would anyone give a kid that much money? It seems almost impossible to offend Beto, so she pushes it.
Are you sure you didn't take it when he was sleeping or something?
He laughs.
Way, I'd have to have some huevazos to do a thing like that.
He shakes his head.
Or a death wish.
Okay, she says.
I don't have a death wish, he clarifies. I like being alive.
Good, she says, despite everything. Lydia crushes the styrofoam bowl in her fist without meaning to, and a dribble of sauce runs into her palm. She wipes it on her jeans and then looks at Beto's round face. He's a philosopher, she thinks. He's rough, but he means what he says. And his openness is a provocation. Despite everything, he likes being alive. Lydia doesn't know whether that's true for herself. For mothers, the question is immaterial anyway. Her survival is a matter of instinct rather than desire.
If you want to know the truth, I think it's more than he meant to give me, Beto confesses suddenly. He was pretty stoned.
Ah, now it makes sense.
I told him I'd pay him back when I got a job in El Otro Lado, but he said, after you get across, just keep walking. Don't ever look back here.
Lydia nods. So that was it?
That was it. Here I am.
Here you are. Luca looks over at them, a little boomerang of reassurance, just verifying they're still there. Then he returns his gaze northward.
And nobody's coming after you, right?
I hope not, he says. I paid my taxes, stayed out of prison, always kept up with my child support. He clears his throat and spits into the sidewalk. He squints north toward the wall.
I'm a free man.
Lydia laughs.
You're a character.
That's the word they always use, he says.
character.
She tosses her bowl into the trash can as well. Well, it sounds like you were overdue for some good luck anyway.
That's right, it's my turn, he says. Darle la vuelta a la tortilla.
So, how are you going to cross? She asks. You have plans? Beto sits up taller and studies La Línea from where they sit. It looks as impenetrable as it does in TJ.
Sometimes kids just walk right up to the booth and hand themselves in, he says. Some of the Central American ones can get asylum. You know about that?
Sure. I heard about the caravans.
Lydia had been aware of the migrant caravans coming from Guatemala and Honduras in the way comfortable people living stable lives are peripherally aware of destitution. She heard their stories on the news radio while she cooked dinner in her kitchen. Mothers pushing strollers thousands of miles, small children walking holes into the bottom of their pink crocs, hundreds of families banding together for safety, gathering numbers as they walked north for weeks, hitching rides in the backs of trucks whenever they could, riding La Bestia whenever they could, sleeping in football stadiums and churches, coming all the way to El Norte to plead for asylum. Lydia chopped onion and cilantro in her kitchen while she listened to their histories. They fled violence and poverty, gangs more powerful than their governments. She listened to their fear and determination, how resolved they were to reach Estados Unidos or die on the road in that effort, because staying at home meant their odds of survival were even worse. On the radio, Lydia heard those walking mothers singing to their children, and she felt a pang of emotion for them. She tossed chopped vegetables into hot oil, and the pan sizzled in response. That pang Lydia felt had many parts. It was anger at the injustice. It was worry, compassion, helplessness. But in truth, it was a small feeling, and when she realized she was out of garlic, the pang was subsumed by domestic irritation. Dinner would be bland. Sebastian wouldn't complain, but she'd register the mildest approval on his features, and she'd feel provoked. She'd try not to start an argument. Beto is talking beside her.
I heard if your life is in danger wherever you come from, they're not allowed to send you back there.
To Lydia, it sounds like mythology, but she can't help asking anyway. You have to be Central American to apply for asylum?
Beto shrugs.
Why? Your life in danger?
Lydia sighs. Isn't everyone's?
Chapter 27. The sisters call the coyote from a payphone. They feel like professional telephone users now, and they make the call without Lucas' assistance. Soledad tells the coyote they've arrived in Nogales, and they have three more people now who want to join their crossing.
Can they walk? He asks. This is the no-frills package. They have to be in good shape.
Yeah, Soledad assures him. They're good.
Where are you now?
Soledad presses the receiver to her ear and looks around.
I don't know. We're right by the border, she says. By the train tracks?
You can see the American flag there, on the big white building?
Yes.
Yeah, I know where you are.
The coyote tells her to meet him at a plaza a couple blocks away. He'll be there within the hour. She's excited when she hangs up the phone. She tells Lydia and the boys the news.
He says it's good if you come. We have to go meet him now.
They want to call Papi first, and they try three times, but it's an international call and they don't understand all the codes, so they finally have to enlist Luca's help. It turns out they don't have enough money anyway, so they settle on a prayer instead.
He'll be okay, Rebecca insists.
If she says it enough times, she can maybe make it true. At the Plaza Niños Héroes, there are ornate benches painted a vivid gold, but all the ones set in the shade are already taken. So Luca and Beto sit on the edge of another planter and Lydia sits on a low step nearby. The sisters walk quiet laps together through the square, their arms folded tightly in front of themselves, and their heads tipped toward each other. Lydia watches people notice them, their remarkable beauty, their visible exhaustion. Lydia's worried about so many things, she can't pin one down to examine it. She's worried about being out in the open like this, about being recognized. Whenever someone looks at her and then looks at their cell phone, there's a little racehorse of adrenaline that clobbers through her body. She feels it mostly in her stomach and her joints. She sits close to the wall with her pack at her feet, where she imagines she's inconspicuous. This is the one benefit of being a migrant, of having effected this disguise so completely. They are nearly invisible. No one looks at them, and in fact, people take pains not to look at them. She hopes that general indifference extends to the halcones, if Javier has them there in Nogales. She also worries about money, how expensive the coyote might be, how she'll gain access to her mother's bank account, and even if it works, how little money they'll have left after they cross. She worries about the coyote, too. Her mother's money is their last hope, and the idea of withdrawing that money and handing it over to a stranger is maddening. What questions will she ask him to ascertain the worth of his character? After he has their money, what incentive does he have to get them safely to their destination? What's to keep him from leading them all deep into the desert and abandoning them there to die? And ultimately, what choice does she have? Luca and Beto talk quietly nearby, swinging their feet from the planter, banging their heels against the wall beneath them. Beto scratches a twig along the top of the planter like a pencil. Luca plucks two leaves off a shrub and intertwines their stems, twisting them around in his fingers. So Lydia is worried about all these things, and yet she has a new understanding about the futility of worry. The worst will either happen or not happen, and there's no worry that will make a difference in either direction. Don't think. She leans her elbows on her knees. When he arrives, El Chacal finds the sisters without trying. Dios mío, he says, by way of introduction, shaking his head. Soledad can feel him assessing them, the angles of their faces, the problem of their beauty. She feels the hesitation this causes him, and she likes that hesitation is a thing it causes rather than something else. She's relieved as she watches him push past his reluctance. He nods at them. Soledad? He says. Me, she responds. And this is my sister Rebecca. She pinches her sister's elbow, and Rebecca nods. He's a small man, only slightly taller than the sisters. His face is handsome, with angular cheekbones and a clean shave. His cheeks are a shade rosier than the rest of his skin, which makes him look more cheerful than he otherwise might. He's wiry and lean in his clean Levi's and red Gap t-shirt. He looks like a migrant himself, except his Adidas sneakers appear brand new. Where are the others? He asks. They're sitting, Soledad says, over there. She walks toward them, and the coyote follows. Ay, he says when he sees them. A lady and two kids? He shakes his head. The boys are already in earshot, and they both hop down from the planter. You don't have to worry about me, Beto says. I'm 23. I just have a growth disorder. Beto knows the words growth disorder because one of the kids he knew in El Dompe had a growth disorder, and even though that kid was the same age as Beto, he stopped growing when they were both six, and Beto kept going until he was twice the boy's height. It was one of the visiting priests from San Diego who told them about growth disorders. It didn't matter anyway, because knowing the words didn't make the kid start growing again. Beto grins at the coyote. 23, de verdad? El Chacal says. Plus, I have the voice of an angel, Beto says, and then he places one hand on his heart and breaks into song. A very loud, not entirely off-key rendition of some pop song Lucas heard before, but doesn't know the name of. When he gets to the rap part, El Chacal holds up one hand to shush him. Impressive though, right? Beto says. They called me the J Balvin of El Dompe. The coyote looks unblinkingly at Beto, who does an impromptu tap dance right there in the middle of the square. Okay, okay, siéntate. El Chacal doesn't like to draw attention. Beto hoists himself back onto the edge of the planter. Lydia stands. My son and I have come all the way from Guerrero. We rode La Bestia. We are capable. We won't slow you down. Rebecca speaks up. You wouldn't believe the things that little dude can do. He could walk a week in the desert if he had to. The coyote frowns, turns to Soledad. Your cousin told you I have a good track record, yes?
Yes.
You know why I have a good track record? She shakes her head. Because I don't take kids. I don't like leaving people behind. I don't like people dying in the desert. So I choose people who won't die. Luca holds on to his mother's hand.
I have no intention of dying, he says.
El Chacal turns his attention to the boy. No one intends to die, he says to Luca.
Yes, Luca concedes,
but I intend not to die. Lydia holds her breath. She can see that Luca's making an impression.
There's a difference, Luca says.
Oh? The coyote leans back to get a better look at Luca's face beneath Papi's cap.
Yes, Luca says. I have considered it.
You've considered it, El Chacal laughs.
You have considered dying?
Of course, Luca says. And?
And I'm not interested in dying yet.
The coyote nods.
I see.
So I will stay alive.
Okay.
With or without your help, Luca says. Lydia pinches the back of his neck lightly.
But of course, your help would be a significant advantage.
Now the coyote laughs harder. Órale, he says, holding his hands up in front of him.
Okay, okay.
Beto hops down to the ground. The kid knows when to keep quiet. He doesn't say a word.
Okay, the coyote says again. Then he looks at Lydia. You can pay?
She tries to make her face blank, her voice loose.
What is the price?
5,000 for you, 6 each for the kids.
Dollars?
Lydia's mouth drops open.
Claro.
The sisters paid only 4 each.
But I thought...
The coyote intercepts her argument. It's not a negotiation. I have enough pollitos to cross without you. I don't need the money. If you want to come, that is the price.
Lydia closes her mouth. She's short. She doesn't know exactly how short, but they don't have enough.
Her stomach drops, and for the first time in days, she feels like she's going to cry. The flare of her nostrils, the swamp of fluid into her sinuses, it's almost a relief. She wasn't sure she was still capable of crying.
How much is that in pesos?
Beto removes a wad of cash from his pocket and is flicking through it, counting. The coyote pushes Beto's hands down out of sight.
Put it away, he says. You trying to get killed or just robbed?
Beto stuffs the money back into his pocket while the coyote looks around to see if anyone's watching them.
Listen, if we're going to do this, the first thing is you have to not be an idiot, okay?
Beto looks sheepish and doesn't clown.
Okay, he says with genuine remorse. Sorry.
The coyote nods. Don't do anything until I tell you to do it, right? Beto nods again.
You don't even piss or sneeze without my permission. And for God's sake, you don't bawl out with a wad of money and start counting it in the middle of the street.
Okay.
El Chacal returns his attention to Soledad. It's going to be tight quarters in the apartment with the extra people, but it's only a couple of days.
Apartment? She asks.
She's taken her backpack off to drink from her water bottle. Luca and Beto collect their things.
Yeah, a place I use for staging. You'll be there a day or two until the others arrive.
He begins to walk, and Lydia grabs her backpack to fall in step behind him.
I need to go to a bank first, she says.
He turns and looks at her, eyebrows up.
A bank?
He says, as if she's requested they stop by the moon for a moment.
Yes, to get your money, she says.
A bank? El Chacal says again. Maybe I should have charged you more. He laughs when he says this, and although Lydia is cheered by his unexpected congeniality, by his quickness to laugh, she can't manage to join him. Lydia is relieved to find a branch of her mother's bank nearby, and she leaves Luca outside with the sisters. The building looks freshly whitewashed, and it makes her aware of how worn-looking and dirty she is. She pauses to check her reflection in the window. She's been wearing the same powder-blue button-up blouse for 3 days. Her armpits feel damp, and her hair is a mess. She hopes she smells okay. She can't tell anymore. Lydia never wore makeup when she was younger, but since she turned 30, she's taken extra care with a bit of powder most mornings, a light dusting to cover the lines across her forehead. At work, she wore a light coat of mascara and a slick of nude lip gloss. She washed her hair every second day and usually wore it in a ponytail when she was stocking the shelves. The woman in the window looks nothing like the recent Lydia. This woman is thinner and darker, with ropes of muscles in her neck and arms. This unshowered woman has dark circles beneath her eyes and a grim visage. She wishes for the armor of her small makeup pouch at home, hanging by its drawstring from a wooden hook in the family bathroom. But the bewilderment is almost comforting. Perhaps no one would recognize her from Javier's photograph after all. She'd like to take off the floppy hat too and stuff it into her backpack because she feels ridiculous, like she's going to church in her bathing suit. But even with the changes to her appearance, she'd feel too conspicuous without it.
Enough wishing.
There's a security camera mounted on a bracket above her, and Lydia doesn't want to be on it. She lowers her face beneath the hat as she opens the door of the bank and steps inside. In the fluorescent-lit, air-conditioned vestibule, Lydia's arms immediately come up in goosebumps. Her body has become unused to electric comforts. She rubs both arms to warm herself, removes her mother's bank card from the purse, and checks the account balance again at the ATM. It's still all there, still untouched. 212,871 pesos. Lydia blows air through her parted lips. There's a withdrawal limit of 6,000 pesos per day, and Lydia has delayed this moment for many reasons, not least of which is that she's not sure how she'll get her hands on the money without the required documentation. She knew it was safer to leave the money in the bank while they traveled anyway, but it's also true that delaying the withdrawal was easier for Lydia, who isn't ready to ratify the awful truth that her mother is really gone. She knows it will feel like stealing her mother's money. She wants it to feel that way. Because Lydia has not been able to grieve, there's still some significant way in which she feels like only she and Luca have gone, that the rest of their family is still intact and happy, living their lives as usual in Acapulco. She imagines Sebastian brushing past her hanging makeup pouch in the bathroom each morning, damp from the shower, his bare body wrapped in the blue towel. Lydia wishes she could further delay pulling the plug on that artifice. But the existence of this electronic money is a miracle. A one-shot parachute. She writes her mother's name in a binder on the counter and then waits in a chair until a branch manager calls her into a private cubicle. Lydia sits, setting her backpack on the empty chair beside her. It's a woman who sits in the chair facing her, so that feels like a bit of luck. The woman wears a navy blazer and has a single streak of gray in her hair. Her face is kind. Lydia studies the woman's features for a moment and makes a snap decision. She will tell her everything, all of it. She will throw herself on the mercy of the stranger's kind face. It's only the third time Lydia has told her story. The first was to Carlos in the office above the church in Chilpancingo, and the second was to the nun, Hermana Cecilia, at the first Casa del Migrante in Huehuetoca. Both times, the telling had taken a toll on Lydia, but both times, she'd received in return something that felt like salvation. "What can I do for you today?" the branch manager asks, folding her hands in front of her on the desk. She doesn't lean away or eye the backpack suspiciously. She is gracious, and her name is Paola, according to her square brown name tag. "I," Lydia begins, but then her nostrils flare, and all the words catch in her throat. Lydia presses her eyes closed once, slowly, and begins again. "I need to close my mother's account." "Okay," Paola says. "I can help you with that. Is your mother, can she come with you to do that, or?" "She's deceased," Lydia says. "Oh, I'm so sorry for your loss." Paola says this not unkindly, but mechanically, and only because it's the thing people say. This isn't at all how Lydia wanted to begin, so formal, so cold. She shakes her head, inches her chair closer to the desk. Paola does not back away. "I need your help," Lydia says. Paola nods. "Of course," she says, reaching out to pat Lydia's hand before clasping her own hands together on the desk again. "All we need, then, is her death certificate and a copy of her will, if you have it." Lydia stops the woman from talking by clearing her throat. She looks not at Paola's face, but at the knot of her hands on the desk between them, at the simple gold wedding band. She speaks without looking up. "My mother was murdered. My whole family was murdered by the cartel in Acapulco. My husband, my sister, 16 of my family members." She is speaking very quietly now, leaning toward Paola across the desk, and she can hear that Paola's breathing has changed. No, has stopped, actually. She glances up at the woman's face and sees the same stillness there. It's a paralysis born of empathy, so Lydia chases the rest of the words out of her mouth quickly, before she loses her nerve or her track, before she begins to cry. "My son and I escaped. He's there, just outside. We had money, but we were kidnapped in Sinaloa, and now it's gone. And we need my mother's money to pay the coyote now, to get across. I'm my mother's only remaining child." There's only one hand left on the desk now, the one with the wedding ring. The other has gone up to Paola's face, to Paola's mouth, where its presence might prevent the escape of some of Paola's informal reaction. "Oh my God," Paola says. Because what else could she possibly say? She opens a lower drawer and withdraws a box of tissues, which she places on the desk between them. "That birthday party massacre in Acapulco? I read about you, your family. Oh my God, I'm so sorry." "Thank you," Lydia says. "It was my niece's quinceañera, Jennifer." Paola crumples a tissue from the box and holds it beneath her nose. Lydia takes one too. Then they look at each other in the eye. Lydia whispers, "Do you have children?" Paola nods. "3. I'm afraid we're going to die. This money is the only way to save my son." Paola pushes her rolling chair back from the desk. "Wait here," she says. She's gone for what feels like a very long time, and when she returns, she's carrying a folder stacked with documents. She sits back into the chair, and Lydia straightens her posture. Paola opens a folder and, using the mouse, clicks the computer monitor to life. "Do you have any identification?" "Yes." Lydia digs into her backpack and finds her voter ID card. She hands it to Paola, who studies it for a moment, looks more closely at Lydia's face, and then sets it on the folder.
Bank card?
Yes, she produces this as well.
Are you a custodian on your mother's account?
No.
And you don't have a death certificate for her, I'm sure, Paola says.
No.
Or a copy of her will?
No. Lydia tries not to panic. Surely this woman is going to try to help her. She understands. She knows that Lydia has none of these documents, has no way of obtaining any of these documents without returning to Guerrero and getting herself killed.
But what if it's simply impossible? What if Paola is trying to help Lydia find a loophole, but all she's really doing is confirming the inevitable bad news, that Lydia has no legal right to this money? Lydia tries to breathe deeply, but everything shakes.
What is your line of work? Paola asks.
I own a bookstore in Acapulco.
Or I did. I guess I still do. Paola types into the computer. Name of the business?
Palabras y páginas.
She types some more and then twists the monitor so Lydia can see. She's not filling in forms, Lydia realizes. She's Googling her, verifying her story, making sure this is not a con job. This is you? She's opened the website Lydia's been meaning to update. There is her picture on the contact page. She's wearing black leggings and an oversized sweater. It's an outfit she'll never wear again. It's in her dirty clothes hamper in Acapulco. Lydia's unremarkable happiness in the photograph takes her breath away, and a sob cuts loose into the cubicle. Lydia wishes the wall stretched all the way to the ceiling. Her eyes are two lines, her mouth a line. She nods her head at Paola, who reaches across the desk and squeezes Lydia's hand. Then she stands and steps around the desk. She removes Lydia's backpack from the chair and sits down beside her.
My nephew disappeared last August, Paola whispers. He was missing for 3 days. When they found him, his head...
She pauses for a long moment, so Lydia thinks she might not continue, but she's only gathering strength.
His head was separated from his body.
Her hand trembles in Lydia's. They squeeze each other tightly.
He was a beautiful boy, she says.
And now it's Lydia's turn to experience that empathy paralysis. The depth of her feeling surprises her. Because how can she have any leftover grief available for other people? For Paola's murdered nephew? But there it is. An anguish that makes her feel hollow in the bones. Despair for a beautiful boy Lydia never met. For the innumerable griefs of all those stolen boys, stretching from family to family like one of Lucas's connected dots. It's so big, the pain. It's exponential. Each violent death amplifies itself 100 times, 1,000 times. Everyone in this bank knows some small or large portion of that grief. Everyone in Nogales. Everyone who lives in a place that's been carved up into plazas and parceled out for governance by men like Javier.
For what?
Lydia lets go. All the torrent of emotion she's been corralling for weeks, it all tries to squeeze through at once. She curls into a tight ball in the wooden chair, and she sobs quietly. And her body is a knot of grief. And Paola is a stranger, but her hands on Lydia's back are the hands of God.
They are Sebastián's and Yemi's and Jennifer's.
They are her mother's hands.
Lydia weeps into Paola's lap, and Paola weeps with her. They weep for themselves and for each other. And when they're finished, they clean themselves up using only the Kleenex on Paola's desk.
Paola rubs Lydia's knee roughly, and then honks her nose into a tissue. She tosses it like a 3-pointer into the wastebasket on the far side of the little cubicle. And then,
I might lose my job. She says quietly, but I will get you that money.
Lydia's head pounds.
She closes her eyes in grateful disbelief. The aftermath is like a jackhammer in her sinuses. It takes a few minutes, but soon there's an envelope fat with cash, and then Paola produces her own purse from a locked drawer in the bottom of her filing cabinet and hands Lydia an extra 500 peso note. "For your son," she says. Lydia hugs her, and there's no way to thank her. It's impossible.
Chapter 28. The apartment is weirdly nice, if impersonal and sparsely furnished. It's the lower level of a house that's built into a hill, so it's half a flight down from the street. It has four large rooms, a living room, with two black leather couches, a flat-screen television, and some grim artwork, a kitchen, whose refrigerator contains only a jar of mayonnaise and two eggs, and the two bedrooms, which are entirely empty, save a lone wire hanger on the tile floor in one, and an aerosol can of Raid on the high windowsill in the other. At the sleek kitchen counter, Lydia hands over their money. The price El Chacal demanded was $11,000. She gives it to him half in pesos and half in dollars, because the bank didn't have enough cash to give her all one currency. The two stacks of bills she hands him include all the money from her mother's account, the 500 peso note Paola gave her, and every penny she had left in her wallet. The exchange rate has been dismal, so the total sum of her money is roughly $10,628. A few weeks ago, when the peso was stronger, it would have been enough. Today, she's $372 short. The coyote counts the money, works out the exchange on his cell phone, and when he realizes she's short, pushes the cash back at her, shaking his head. No es suficiente. But we're only a little short. Maybe I can pay you when we get to the other side. When I get a job, I can make up the difference. That's not how it works. It's inconceivable that it might come down to this. $372. We had more, but we got robbed on the way. She hears the desperation in her voice. Everyone gets robbed on the way, he says, unmoved. No, Soledad says. She paid to ransom us. She saved our lives with that money. Rebecca turns to her sister. We can ask Cesar. We have to. Soledad looks worried about asking their cousin for even more money, but she nods. There's a note of hysteria in the room, hopping from face to face. Only the coyote is immune to it. We won't be leaving for at least a day or two, he says. You can stay here with your son. You come up with the cash before then, you can come. 2 days, Lydia thinks. They'd lived frugally in Acapulco, never touching their savings, taking a packed lunch to work most days, buying new clothes only when the old ones could no longer be repaired. The rare dinner out, an occasional movie. This is how they splurged. For their anniversary last year, Sebastian bought her a vial of lavender oil so she could put a drop on her pillow each night before bed. What a luxury that had been. But when she thinks now of their small, sunny two-bedroom apartment filled with shoes and books gathering dust, its kitchen pantry stocked with uneaten maize, dry beans, and cereal, the linens folded in the hall closet, two bubble-shaped wine glasses drying in the rack beside the sink, it all feels like extravagance. She has nothing now. What can she sell? How can she possibly get $400 in 2 days? Her mind searches for people she can ask for money. Dead. All dead. If she had her uncle's number in Denver, she might call. She thinks wildly, shamefully, of her body. How much could she get for sex? It's sickening and obscene, and she's grateful when she manages to discard the thought without real analysis. She will find a way. Beto and Luca are sitting on one of the black leather couches behind them, playing some game about cars, but they can feel the strange tremor of agitation in the room, and they are drawn to it. They appear magnetically, one on each side of Lydia.
"What's wrong, mommy?"
Luca asks.
"Nothing, amorcito, no te preocupes."
But Beto, who's accustomed to having to work things out without people explaining them to him, looks at the stacks of money on the counter, and then at Lydia's face, and then at El Chacal, and says,
"How much is she short?"
El Chacal lifts his phone from the counter and reads from the screen, $372, and then sets the phone back down.
"How much is that in pesos?"
Beto asks. The coyote does the math. "About 7,500. Beto goes into his pocket and flicks out his wad of cash while Lydia watches. He already paid for his crossing and still has money to burn.
"We just met this kid this morning," she thinks. "He doesn't even understand how much money this is."
She rejects her misgivings instantly. He covers it. She draws him in and hugs him.
"Thank you."
El Chacal tells him they'll cross when the other pollitos arrive, and they should make themselves comfortable while they wait. He leaves them with almost no instruction, and after he's gone, Lydia wonders if he'll ever come back. They've given him everything, their very last chance of escaping to El Norte. He doesn't seem like a thief, but what if he is? Or what if he gets hit by a bus? She balls her hands into fists and tells herself to shut up. Don't think. They all take their shoes off as soon as the coyote is gone, and it's incredible what a pleasure it is to be barefoot, to wiggle your toes freely without constraint.
Con un olor a queso.
Luca and Beto run up and down the hallway between the kitchen and the bedrooms, feeling the cool tiles beneath their sticky feet, and making tiny footprints of phantom condensation along the floor. Soledad tucks in her t-shirt and shows them a trick she can do, a handstand against the wall, her arms strong beneath her. The boys applaud. When they try to watch TV, they discover that the flat screen doesn't work. Lydia finds a dog-eared paperback in one of the kitchen drawers and reads while the boys and sister snap. It's an older novel, a Stephen King book Lydia read many years ago, and slipping back into it is briefly transporting, like she can reach back through time and commune with the person she was when she first read it. That act of communion feels both lucky and holy. When the others awaken, she abandons the book with some reluctance, leaves it face down on the couch, cracked open at the spine to page 73. They all look forward to taking showers and are disappointed to find there's no hot water. There's also no food or pots and only one frying pan in the kitchen. But Lydia heats up what little water she can in that so they can sponge the dust and sweat from their skin. They eat nothing, contenting themselves with a relatively recent memory of the birria and fall asleep as the sun sets. Early the next morning, just as they're discussing how and what to eat, the door opens and Lydia buckles with relief when El Chacal descends the four steps, followed by two men and an older woman. He's still here. He hasn't abandoned them. This relief is soon followed by fear. Who are these people? Lydia watches them for clues, for recognition. The men seem to know each other. They are young and wear their baseball caps low over their eyes, talking quietly together while ignoring the others. Long sleeves and jeans hide any possible tattoos. Lydia experiences a trigger wash of nausea, but it's chased off by her hunger.
"Don't go far," the coyote says. "If you're not here when it's time to go, we won't wait."
It's tense in the apartment after El Chacal leaves. The sisters and Luca retreat to the bedroom where they slept last night, and the new woman locks herself in the bathroom. Lydia wants to find out all she can about the newcomers, but she also wants to keep her distance, to remain imperceptible and vague. And anyway, she's hungry. Luca is hungry.
Are you hungry?
She asks the new men, who are seated on the couch. They are.
I will cook, if you have money for food.
She will make omelets, a warm morsel of familiarity for Luca. The men give her some pesos, and she and Luca set out to find a grocery store.
Wear your new boots, she tells him. Let's break them in.
They're only a half block from the apartment when they hear someone calling out behind them.
Hola, perdón, señora. Disculpe.
Lydia turns with trepidation and finds the new woman from the apartment hurrying toward them.
I thought I might come with you if you don't mind, the woman says. I need to get a few things myself.
She carries a purple handbag and is dressed as if going out for a nice meal. Black trousers, an oversized blouse, and wedge sandals. She's slim and dark-skinned with short-cropped hair, black with sparks of silver. A gold bracelet on one wrist is too understated to be fake. She looks nothing like a migrant, Lydia thinks, and then remembers that neither does she. Or at least she didn't when they first embarked on this journey.
I'm Marisol.
The bracelet dangles when the woman extends her hand for Lydia to shake.
Lydia. Mucho gusto.
And this is my son, Luca.
Hello, Luca.
At the corner, an elderly gentleman sits in his doorway, and Lydia asks him to point the way to the nearest shop. He does.
I need to buy fruit, Marisol says as they walk. I'm used to eating salad every day, and my stomach has been all messed up since I got back.
Back? Lydia asks.
From California.
Oh, you were in California already?
Yes, 16 years, she says. I'm practically a gabacho now.
They both laugh. But then why did you come back? Lydia asks.
Not by choice.
Lydia winces.
My daughters are still there in San Diego.
She reaches into a side pocket of her purse and draws out an iPhone with a shiny case. She unlocks it with her thumb and scrolls to a photograph of two beautiful young girls, perhaps close in age to Soledad and Rebecca. She shows them to Lydia proudly. The younger one is wearing a quinceañera dress.
That's my Daisy, she says. She wanted to wear a Chiapas dress for her birthday, even though she was born in San Diego. She doesn't even speak Spanish.
She closes the phone and returns it to her purse.
And my older one, America, she's in college now, trying to take care of her younger sister, trying to take care of the house.
Marisol's voice sounds thick and tired. How long have you been gone?
Almost 3 weeks, Marisol says. But I was in a detention center for more than 2 months before that.
She shakes her head and presses her lips together in a gesture Lydia recognizes. It's the one when you're resolute about keeping your shit together despite the fact that your voice is quivering and your chest feels cleaved with sorrow. Luca doesn't seem to be listening, but Lydia knows better. He's always listening now, walking a few steps ahead of them and watching the cars come and go.
What happened? Lydia asks.
Marisol takes a big breath before answering.
We went legally when America was only 4 years old. My husband was an engineer. He had work there, so we got visas. And then Daisy was born, and years went by. You don't even notice the time going by.
Lydia finds herself instinctively drawing close to Marisol as they walk up and down the sunny hillside streets, around corners, and through quiet intersections. Luca strides heavily in his new boots.
Then 5 years ago, Rogelio was killed. My husband was killed.
Marisol blesses herself, and Lydia gasps involuntarily.
I'm so sorry, Lydia says.
Marisol nods.
It was very sudden.
a car accident as he was returning home from work.
Something treacherous and unkind lurches up in Lydia, a jealousy almost of that kind of widowing, a normal, ungruesome death. But then she follows it. Rogelio is no less dead than Sebastian. By the time she squeezes Marisol's arm, her compassion is genuine again.
Our visas lapsed when he died. We were supposed to return home to Oaxaca. Only Daisy was permitted to stay because she's a citizen.
But that's absurd, Lydia says. She's how old?
15.
Aye. She's heard the stories, of course. But it's different talking to a mother who's actually living it. Lydia can't imagine being separated from Luca on top of all the other griefs. He's there, walking just ahead of them. But Lydia has to fight the urge to lunge for him, to crush him to her chest. Lydia's always been a devoted mother, but she's never been the codependent kind who misses her child when he goes to school or to sleep. She's always treasured the time to herself, to inhabit her own thoughts, to have a break from the nonstop emotional clamoring of motherhood. There were even times in Acapulco when she'd experienced a sliver of resentment at the way he barged into her heart and mind whenever he was around, how Luca's energy usurped everything else in the room. She loved that boy with her whole heart, but my God, there were days when she couldn't fully breathe until she'd left him at the schoolyard gate. That's all over now. She would staple him to her, sew him into her skin, affix her body permanently to his now, if she could. She'd grow her hair into his scalp, would become his conjoined twin mother. She would forego a private thought in her head for the rest of her life if she could keep him safe. Luca waits at the corner, and Lydia looks beyond him across the street where the side of a building is painted with graffiti. A giant question mark. No. No, it's not a question mark. Lydia stops cold. She puts her hand out for Luca.
Mijo.
Are you okay? Marisol asks. It's not a question mark. It's a sickle. And beneath the sickle, in fresh black paint, the slanted letters warn, Vienen los jardineros. Perched on the curved blade is an owl, La lechuza. And then something new, something Lydia has not seen before. A perfect, faceless rendering of Javier's distinctive glasses. The exact shape as to provoke in her memory the man himself. Where the lenses would be, someone has scrawled, Aún te está buscando. He is still looking for you. For me. He is looking for me, Madre de Dios. Lydia turns on her heel. Luca, come. But mommy, come. She snaps her voice like a whip. Marisol jogs to catch up with her. Are you okay? She asks again. After 17 days, 1,600 miles. Here, on the doorstep to El Norte, los pinche jardineros. How flawlessly the artist has rendered Javier's glasses, as if he's familiar with them, as if he's seen them in person, here in Nogales. Lydia will fall down on the street. Her knees will give way. The wind passes through her body as if she's mostly holes, a ghost already. Marisol reaches out to steady her.
We cannot go that way, Lydia says, and she's walking quickly now, but not too quickly, not quickly enough to draw the attention of those three boys leaning against the wall of the bodega.
Her arms feel clattery in their sockets, her knees liquid with panic.
Okay, it's okay.
Marisol puts an arm around Lydia's shoulder, and they fall in step together, Lydia's stride matching the older woman's accidentally. And here's Luca, tucking beneath her other arm. And they're already half a block away, the other direction, and now they turn a corner onto a shadier street. And Lydia doesn't know if the direction they're going is any safer than the one they'd been traveling before. And does Marisol know where they're going?
Is she leading them somewhere? Lydia shakes herself out from beneath the woman's arm.
Thank you, I'm fine now, she says. I'm fine, we're fine.
She grabs Luca by the hand.
I just remembered something we have to do, she says. We'll see you back at the apartment later.
Marisol stops, confused.
Oh,
we'll be back soon, she says, and she drags Luca across another street, and they leave Marisol standing alone in the middle of the road.
They have to get off the street, out of sight, away from anyone who might recognize them.
Los jardineros are here, in Nogales, perhaps as an alliance, perhaps as a test market, a turf war,
perhaps only to hunt her, to find her, to take her back to Javier so he can finish the job of eradicating Sebastián's entire family in return for Marta's death.
Lydia can see it as if she's there, in that dorm room in Barcelona, a creaking sound from above. Marta's feet swinging slightly in their navy blue tights, one chunky black shoe still clinging to her left foot, the right one fallen to the floor beneath.
Lydia squeezes her mind closed against the image and against the certainty that Javier would follow her here, will follow her indefinitely across anyone's territory until he finds her. Only in El Norte will his power be diminished. In El Norte, where there's no impunity for violent men. At least not for violent men like him, she thinks. There are no sidewalks here. The garden gates and shop fronts sit directly at the edge of the streets. Cars have to swerve around the pedestrians. There's no place to hide. They turn at the next corner and head back the way they came. Lydia's not wearing her hat. Why didn't she wear her hat? She hates that floppy pink thing. She'd like the idea of liberating herself from it long enough to buy groceries and pretend normalcy for an hour. Until the graffiti, it had felt like a jaunt. Things had gone well yesterday at the bank. The apartment was comfortable. They were so close. She had let her guard down. Estúpida. An old woman leans against her door jamb and calls out to them as they pass. Fruta, pan, leche, huevos. It's not the supermarket Lydia's been in search of, but maybe it's better. A woman selling the basics out of a makeshift shop in the dark front room of her house. They duck inside, and Lydia keeps an eye on the street through the open door. They buy eggs, tortillas, onions, an avocado, and some fruit.
Do you have a hat? Lydia asks her.
A hat? The woman shakes her head.
Or a scarf. Anything for my hair.
No, lo siento.
It's okay. Thanks anyway.
Wait, the woman snaps her fingers and totters into the kitchen. She returns with a thin blue dish towel adorned by a pattern of flowers and hummingbirds. She presents it to Lydia like a bottle of fine wine and gestures that she could use it to cover her hair.
How much? Lydia asks.
100 pesos.
Lydia nods and ties a cloth over her hair like a handkerchief.
What about for him? The old woman points at Luca with her chin, and Lydia turns to look at him, confused. Are you crossing? She asks, this time using her chin to point north toward La Frontera.
Lydia hesitates for only a moment and then confesses.
Yes. We're crossing.
He needs a coat, the lady says. It gets very cold.
He has a sweatshirt and a warm jacket.
Wait, the woman disappears into the kitchen again, and Lydia and Luca can hear her banging through cupboards or closets, shifting things around, dragging a box across the floor. Luca giggles in the leftover quiet, but Lydia's too nervous to join him. She eyes both doorways, interior and exterior. When the lady returns, she's carrying two lumps of knitted blue yarn, which she spreads across the counter so Lydia can assess their shapes. A hat and scarf. Perhaps a little too big for Luca, but the yarn is thick and warm. Lydia touches the soft wool with her fingertips and nods.
How much?
The old woman waves at Luca.
Un regalito, she says. Para la suerte.
They move through the streets as quickly and carefully as they can. Each window and door they pass feels like a possible booby trap. She counts her steps to try and keep herself calm. Luca carries the eggs and tortillas. She carries the bag with the produce. She considers Marisol as they go, her apparent kindness and sorrow. Behind Lydia's fear, she might find room to feel bad about the abrupt way she left Marisol standing in the street. The fact that she hadn't followed them, hadn't insisted or attempted to redirect them, that feels to Lydia like probable evidence that she's no nefarious actor. She probably is who she claims to be, a deported mother, desperate to return to her daughters in California. When Lydia sees the house where their apartment is, she holds her breath. She looks behind her, only one car on the street. It approaches slowly, and Lydia doesn't exhale until it rolls past them. The elderly couple inside giving Luca a friendly wave as they go.
Thank you, God, she says out loud when they step through the door and close it behind them.
She leans against it for a moment and allows herself to breathe before, together, she and Luca descend the steps back into the apartment. There are voices and laughter below, and it's warmer inside than on the street, humid with people. Lydia walks in, and when she gets to the bottom step, she drops her grocery bag to the floor.
Surprise!
Lorenzo is seated on the black leather couch. Lydia cannot immediately respond. An avocado rolls out from the toppled bag.